From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's vice president and secretaries of defense and state were all in Europe this past week. Pence, Mattis, and Tillerson. Their message? Europe, we're with you. NATO is our shared defense, and Russia is a challenge. Beef up your military spending, but otherwise, we're good. For the most part, it was music to European ears, but also confusing, because President Trump has been singing a different tune, calling NATO obsolete and applauding Brexit. This hour on Point, the road ahead for Europe, the U.S., NATO, and Russia in the age of Trump. You can join us on air or online. What's the state of the Transatlantic Alliance? Is the U.S. where it needs to be with Europe? And where is that exactly? Are you concerned about the mixed signals coming from this administration? And joining me via Skype from Brussels is Tom Nuttall. He covers European politics and economics at as the Charlemagne columnist at The Economist. And Tom Nuttall, good to have you. Thanks for joining us. Very grateful.
Hi there.
Yeah, good to have you. So set this up for us. As we know, President Trump has had a lot to say about Europe, that NATO is obsolete, that Europe should pay more for its defense. He's had a kind of bromance with the pro-Brexit advocate Nigel Farage, said that other nations could end up leaving the EU, which is, which has given a real sense of uncertainty in Europe. So give us a sense of the atmosphere in Europe right now around the Trump administration.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're exactly right. I think right now, the prevailing mood here in Brussels and in many European capitals, it's just absolute bafflement. So we had, starting last week, we had a series, it was a sort of a grand reassurance tour from senior members of the administration, General Mattis, Vice President Pence, and the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at various meetings across Europe, most recently the Vice President here in Brussels yesterday. And as you said, they were largely delivering messages of reassurance. And I suppose one of the funny things is that what we heard from a lot of them, particularly at the Munich Security Conference last weekend, was what you might say was a fairly sort of conventional Republican take on foreign policy and the relationship with European allies. And in normal times, it wouldn't really be newsworthy. We've heard this sort of thing many times before from previous administrations. But of course, these are not ordinary times and we're not operating with a normal president. So when you're a European ally and you hear the president say that NATO is obsolete, you hear him cheering on Brexit, you have suspicions that he may be about to strike a deal with Vladimir Putin, and then you hear his most senior cabinet secretaries deliver messages which in some cases seem to be directly opposed to what the president is saying, you're left wondering, well, who's in charge here and how are we supposed to know what American policy is? So I think that's where we are right now. And the Europeans are going to be watching what happens, how American foreign policy develops now very, very closely indeed.
Well, Tom Nuttall, let's listen to a little bit of tape from the weekend. So here was Vice President Mike Pence at the Munich Security Conference on Saturday bringing a message of tough love for America's European allies. Here's what he said.
We will meet our obligations to our people to provide for the common defense, and we'll continue to do our part to support our allies in Europe and in NATO. But Europe's defense requires your commitment as much as ours.
And then on Monday, Pence said the U.S. commitment to the European Union was steadfast and enduring. And here was European Council President Donald Tusk after his meeting with Pence yesterday, thankful for Pence's assurances, but still expressing some worry.
Too much has happened over the past month in your country, in the EU. Too many new and sometimes surprising opinions have been voiced over this time about our relations and our common security for us to pretend that everything is as it used to be.
So, Tom Nuttall, too much has happened for us to pretend that everything as it used to be, a statement there from European Council President Donald Tusk. That sort of sums up, it seems to me, this kind of uncertainty about these conflicting messages coming from Washington.
Yes. So, I mean, Mr. Tusk has a particular way of expressing the concerns that many Europeans feel about the state of the European Union. So, I mean, the EU has been facing an endless cascade of crises for the last few years, nothing to do with Donald Trump, from everything from the Eurozone to refugees to terrorism to Brexit to Russia, all of these things. So there's a real sense of sort of we're under siege here and we cannot take any more threats to our unity. And then along comes a president who seems to represent a threat to that unity. And I think that's the way to understand the comments that he made yesterday. Now, I can tell you that he was very pleased with the meeting that he had with Vice President Pence. He heard everything that he thought he needed to hear from him by way of reassurance. But once again, that only answers half the question, or perhaps less than half the question, because we still don't understand what sort of foreign policy the president is going to pursue. And of course, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, it is the president that is the decider, not the vice president, not the secretary of state, not the defense secretary, not anyone. So I think there's still very much an open question as to what sort of policy the president will be pursuing vis-a-vis his European allies.
Well, we're going to be digging into that big question during this hour. Listeners, we're talking about the Trump administration's first big foray into Americans' relationship with Europe and NATO. And Tom Nuttall, stand by. I want to introduce Richard Armitage in Arlington, Virginia. He's president of Armitage International. He's co-chair of a task force convened by the Carnegie Endowment and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on the road forward on Russia. He previously served as U.S. Deputy Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration and as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And Secretary Armitage, welcome to On Point. It's very good of you to join us.
Hello, Mr. Brook. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'd love to get your initial response to what you heard Tom Nuttall and I talking about. What do you see in these visits? Did the new administration lay out clear defense, security, and foreign policy positions in Europe this week? What are you hearing?
Mr. Brook, if I may, before I answer directly your question, I think when one looks at the U.S. approach to Europe, we also have to take into consideration the fact that in Europe there's a dangerous wave of populist nationalism. And there are also threats to U.S.-EU unity through Russian propaganda and information ops and subversion, as we used to see during the Cold War. So it's a very complicated mix. Mm-hmm. I think the major members of our administration approach Europe from a traditional point of view, putting our interests and our values right, as we'll defend our NATO allies and we'll defend the norms that underpin the international community. But your correspondent is exactly correct. Whether that extends to the White House, I don't know. I think we can have a slight bit more optimism this morning than we did yesterday because of the announcement of H.R. McMaster to the National Security Advisor. This is a steady and steadying hand.
You're talking about Donald Trump's appointment of Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster, who will be his national security advisor. So you see this as a bit of encouraging news coming out of the Trump administration.
Well, we're getting a real center of gravity in the administration with some real grown-ups. H.R. certainly is. Rex Tillerson, General Mattis, General Kelly. I think these are traditional, solid thinkers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, I don't know. I don't think it matters. They've spent most of their lives defending our interests and our values, and I fully expect them to air every one of these issues fully in front of the president.
Well, Mr. Armitage, I'd love for you to come back, though, to the point that you touched on and that Tom Nuttall so well expressed. To the extent that there is uncertainty about just what President Trump's position is toward Europe. We've heard from his surrogates, and as we heard, the Europeans were somewhat encouraged by what they heard. But to the extent that there is still uncertainty about what the president's position is in Europe, what's the risk of that?
Well, the risk, I think, I started to outline that the unity of the U.S. and EU can be undermined by this subversion from Russia, and this siren song might be heard in some quarters. It's not a state secret that populism is sweeping some parts of Europe, and I think populists can fall victim to the siren song. I'm hopeful that this administration will loudly and clearly demonstrate their affection for U.S.-EU unity and will make it clear beyond the shadow of a doubt. I think our president is still kind of finding his way and not yet fully understanding that when he tweets out some piece of nonsense or another. It has a very wide audience, far beyond the audience just in the United States.
Tom Nuttall, I'd like to get you back into this conversation and respond to what Richard Armitage was talking about you know, some of the same populist waves that obviously had a lot to say about what happened here in the United States are also sweeping across Europe.
Yes, this is a very important point. So one of the biggest concerns that many European officials have is about exactly this. So you have the rise of parties or politicians like Marine Le Pen, who is running for president in France, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, many, many more across the continent, all of whom see in the victory of Donald Trump a model for their own battles against their own elites. I was at the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, I was at a convention of many of these politicians in a small town in Germany, and the energy from the inauguration was crackling through the room. You know, you could really feel it. If Donald Trump can do it over there, why the hell can't we do it over here? And so there's a real fear amongst some officials here that this administration will overturn what has really been decades of bipartisan American foreign policy, which has been to encourage and pursue a policy of European integration, and that they will be happy to see it go into reverse and perhaps even encourage it. And there's a report just earlier today that Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's senior advisor, had a meeting with the German ambassador in Washington, D.C. recently, in which he said that it would be far better for Europe if the European Union were to break up, and that he may seek to advance such a breakup. Now, this kind of talk really raises the hairs on European officials, because this would be a complete reversal from what we've seen for decades.
Now, a complete reversal about that report. I'm reading Reuters right now. A White House official checked with Bannon in response to that report and confirmed that meeting took place, but said the account provided to Reuters was inaccurate. Quote, they only spoke for about 3 minutes and it was just a quick hello. But still, I take your point, Tom Nuttall. When Europeans read reports like that, raises a lot of questions. We're talking about the Trump administration's first big foray into America's relationship with Europe and NATO. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the Trump administration's policy in Europe, NATO, and Russia, and a continent, Europe, that says it doesn't know where exactly the U.S. stands on the alliance. You can join the conversation. Are the mixed messages from Washington a good thing? Let Trump be Trump, play bad cop while our top officials keep the alliance on track? Where does Russia fit into all of this? My guests are Richard Armitage, who was U.S. Deputy Secretary of State in the younger Bush administration and Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And we've also been talking to Tom Nuttall, Charlemagne columnist at The Economist. And let's hear Donald Trump, who was President Trump in Melbourne, Florida, just this past Saturday, where he said countries that are part of NATO need to pay their dues. Here's what he said.
I'm a NATO fan. But many of the countries in NATO, many of the countries that we protect, many of these countries are very rich countries. They're not paying their bills. They're not paying their bills. They have to help us. No longer are we chained down by the discredited approaches of the past.
President Trump there speaking in Melbourne, Florida this past Saturday. Secretary Armitage, I'd like you to respond to that point by President Trump. Is there some justification in what he's talking about NATO members in Europe needing to step up more and pay their bills?
Well, it certainly wasn't a delicate comment. It lacks a certain elegance, but the underlying fact is that only several of our NATO allies are paying their 2% dues, if you will, which is generally considered membership, a necessity for membership. And so I think that criticism is correct. My personal view is criticism like that, however, is best leveled in person, quietly, and not shouted from a rooftop.
Right. And tell me why. I mean, I defer to you, obviously, as a seasoned diplomat. But when he yells comments like that at a campaign-style rally, what's the danger?
Would you repeat the question?
No, I'm just, you just said it wasn't a delicate comment, and it wasn't the kind of comment that should be shouted from a rooftop. And I'm asking you, what is the danger of that kind of approach, of shouting those kinds of comments at a campaign-style rally?
Thank you, Mr. Book. Look, it's quite clear that the danger is that our president doesn't realize the myriad audiences he's addressing when he says something like that. He's obviously addressing our public. He's also addressing NATO and the EU more broadly. He's also addressing the Russian Federation, whether he realizes or not, and he could be inadvertently sending the wrong signals. This is why I argue for criticisms in private, praise in public.
Mm-hmm. Criticisms in private, praise in public. Tom Nuttall, I'd love to come to you with that same question. When you hear that comment, how is that playing in Europe?
Yeah, this is an interesting issue because America's European allies in NATO were already starting to increase their defense spending long before Donald Trump took office. And this is because, I think for two basic reasons. One is a resurgent Russia on the eastern flank, and we all saw what happened in Ukraine a few years ago, and the fighting continues there, and the threat from terrorism to the south. So to a certain extent, this administration is pushing at an open door. And of course, it's nothing new about an American administration leaning on its European allies to spend more on defense. But as we've just heard, there are ways of conducting this sort of diplomacy. And I think one of the ironies that we may start soon to see is that for several European countries, they're not going to take particularly kindly to being told by Donald Trump, who is very unpopular in Europe, that they ought to do more. So, for example, I would suggest watching Germany, which is about to begin its own election season. And I think defense spending could become an important issue in that election campaign between the two main centre-left and centre-right parties. On the left, they may find it electorally expedient to say, don't do what Donald Trump tells you, don't increase defence spending. So it's a strategy that could end up backfiring, at least in some countries.
Let's take some calls. We've got a lot of listeners who want to get in on this question about Donald Trump and the United States' relationship with NATO, with Europe. Let's go to Kim, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Kim, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Yes, I am very concerned about Donald Trump's mixed messages with NATO. I feel very strongly that our strong, firm alliance with NATO has been a major contribution to the kind of peace we've seen in the Western world, and I think anything that threatens that is unwise.
Kim, your line is breaking up, but we got your message that you have concerns and that NATO has obviously been one of the bedrocks of American foreign policy and an important contributor to peace. We're going to take that on board and get one more comment from David, who's calling from Cecilia, Kentucky. David, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hey, Andrew. I really have a hard time understanding the confusion. It seems to me that it's a pretty simple situation. America's been paying a large part of the bill for defense of the, not only NATO, but as the globe in general, being the police force. And it's come at a tremendous cost to us as far as lives, our economy. We've suffered tremendously with this. And I don't see how saying something is an outdated concept, as NATO should be a more of a partnership, everybody pulling their weight. I don't see how that Donald Trump has given any confusion or misunderstanding to this. It seems pretty self-explanatory.
David, I really appreciate the call, and I'd like to put your point to Secretary Armitage. I know, Mr. Secretary, we only have you for a couple more minutes, but respond to David's concern. I mean, he says he doesn't think Donald Trump is sending a mixed message at all, and it's a perfectly acceptable idea to suggest that European nations pay their fair share.
Well, perhaps your caller and I share a different view. I understand the feeling that everyone should pay a fair share. I think I indicated the same in the 2% of defense spending for 2% GDP for defense spending, which is expected of NATO. However, the United States forces are not Hessian troops. We're not there just to defend NATO. We're there to defend something, a system of 70 years, which is undergirded the international system. And I think the backdrop is important. The backdrop, which was mentioned previously from our friend from Belgium, is that the Russian Federation is resurgent on the East and is trying to undermine that international order, apparently. So that's why there's the confusion.
Yeah. Yeah, would you say, before I let you go, Secretary Armitage, I'd love you to say more about questions regarding Russia, particularly regarding the Trump administration and Russia. It's in the news a lot these days, big questions about contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, Russian hacking that helped the Trump campaign, and of course, President Trump talking favorably about Vladimir Putin and the need to have better relations with Trump. How does that all play out in this conversation about the transatlantic relationship?
Well, Mr. Brook, I think, first of all, you can't one needs to underscore the severity of the break between the United States and the Russian Federation. We have completely competing narratives, 180 degrees out from one another, and that leads to a situation where repairing this breach is going to be long, arduous, and difficult work. So there won't be any breakthrough, although we have, over the past 25 years, had a series of ups and downs with different administrations. With bust and boom, if you will, with Moscow relations, first of all. Second, the confusion has to do with Russia's interference in our election process, the fact that Mr. Trump has had thus far difficulty in settling in the public mind what his view of the Russian Federation is. Now, we have his major lieutenants, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, et cetera, and now H.R. McMaster's, the National Security Advisor, who are known to have a somewhat more jaundiced view of the Russian Federation. These things will work out over time. There will be Senate investigations of Russia's intrusion into the United States. All these things will eventually be made public, and we'll have a better sense on how to gauge the Trump administration.
Well, Richard Armitage, president of Armitage International, he's co-chair of a task force convened by the Carnegie Endowment and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on the road forward on Russia. He was assistant secretary of defense in the Reagan administration. He also served in the administration of George W. Bush, President George W. Bush. Secretary Armitage, thank you so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you, Mr. Brook.
And let me introduce now who's going to be with us for the rest of the hour, John Kornblum. He joins us from Berlin, Germany. He served in a number of high-level diplomatic posts with a focus on Russia and Europe going back to the Nixon administration, former Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, former Deputy U.S. Ambassador to NATO, former U.S. Minister and Deputy Commandant of Forces in Divided Berlin. He's now based in Berlin, Senior Counselor to the international law firm Knorr LLP. John Kornblum. Very good to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Very nice to be with you.
Well, I know you've been listening patiently to this conversation, and I'd love to get your sort of first impression of what's been going on this week as Trump administration surrogates fan out across Europe and try to assure Europeans of the U.S. commitment to the transatlantic alliance. What are you seeing from your perch there in Berlin?
Well, I think I would share the view, which I think also Secretary Armitage said, that the first place, much of the discussion that you're hearing, including Europe having to pay more, et cetera, is a traditional part of U.S.-European relations. And there's a big background to it, which we can get into if you want to. I think the difference here is you have a president who says he's going to abandon all this. This is America first. This is American isolationism. The European Union, he says, is no longer the tool we wish for our relations with Europe, et cetera, et cetera. It's the background noise which is disturbing. The comments by the Secretary of Defense and the Vice President couldn't have been better. But then the background noise is always there, and so you're never quite sure, not just the Europeans, but also Americans. I'm never quite sure what our foreign policy is.
You live and work in the heart of European power, Berlin. What are you hearing from European government officials as the Trump administration?
They're worried. They're worried. And I also do quite a bit of public speaking. I spoke to a group last evening of about 400 people, and the questions you get are not anti-American. They're not even anti-Trump. They're just worried. They're worried that somehow the United States is no longer, as Secretary Armitage put it, committed to this very successful structure of maintaining peace, which has been existed for 70 years, and that somehow something new and unpredictable is coming. And right now in the world, what we don't need is unpredictability.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about that, because I think this came up, both Tom Nuttall and Richard Armitage raised it, this idea of uncertainty. When it comes to this alliance, why is uncertainty so dangerous? Or how dangerous is the question I meant to ask.
Well, it's dangerous for a number of reasons. In the first place, one sentence, the fact that the United States has remained engaged in Europe since 1945, which is a long time after all, is not just because we're defending Europeans. First place, we're maintaining a stable situation in Europe, and Europe is still not stable and solved the way many people believe it to be. We had a big war in the Balkans, which I was dealt with in the 1990s. We have a Russian attack on Ukraine right now. We have all kinds of instabilities. The United States profits immensely from our trade and our investment in Europe. Every single American, big American company has a big operation in Europe. We also profit from the fact that we have this large alliance which can help us both in support and as a platform for dealing with the instabilities in the world. So the whole thing really is based on American self-interest. And if the president now says, I want to put America first, what he should be doing then is saying, and I'm going to do it by building up our relations with Europe. But there is a reason for this. America has never really liked to be engaged overseas. That's part of our national tradition. And so I can tell you over my more than 40 years of dealing with this, it's always been a problem to make sure that we understand why we're in Europe. It's always been difficult to convince everybody of that. So on the one hand, this isn't new. On the other hand, it's because of the president's rhetoric that it's perhaps a little bit more unsettling than it usually is.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Brian, who's calling from Austin, Texas. Brian, you're on the air. It's good to have you. What's your point?
Hi, Anthony. My point comes from a different perspective a little bit. For last 2.5 years before I moved to Austin, I was living in England, and I can testify to this kind of populism that is, you know, anti-European, anti-immigrant. And I guess my question with regards to America and its place in all of this is, is the Trump administration risking, ostracizing Europe by playing up this quote-unquote special relationship with the UK? It seems to me that by being so buddy-buddy with the UK, you could easily scream to the rest of Europe that, you're just not as important.
Interesting question. Tom Nuttall, do you want to take a shot at that? Because, of course, we've already had a visit from Prime Minister Theresa May. There's going to be a state visit. Donald Trump will be heading over to Great Britain soon. He's said yes to a state visit. What do you think about Brian's question?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think I'd probably frame it the other way around, though. I think if there's a European concern about a burgeoning or a sort of a reignition of the so-called special relationship, it's probably going to be directed towards Britain than towards the United States. So as you probably know, we are about to embark upon a negotiation, a two-year negotiation that will set the terms for Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. There are some concerns that Britain will seek to, as it were, a sort of a geopolitical hedge against its to advance its relationship with the United States in case things go wrong in the Brexit negotiations. So that is going to be watched very carefully. The fact that Theresa May was the first, head of government anywhere to visit the United States, certainly the first European one, was watched very carefully in European capitals here. And Britain's approach to the rest of the world, including its trade discussions, may well feed into these Brexit negotiations, which are about to start.
We're discussing the Transatlantic Alliance, America's business with Europe, and how that's going in the first days of the Trump administration. My guests are Tom Nuttall. He covers European politics for The Economist, and John Kornblum. He served in a number of high-level diplomatic posts with a focus on Russia and Europe going back to the Nixon administration. We're going to take a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Uh-huh. Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the way forward for the EU and the U.S. and how NATO will deal with Russia. My guests are John Kornblum in Berlin, with a long track record as a diplomat focused on Europe and Russia, former Assistant Secretary of State, former ambassador to the OSCE, former Deputy U.S. Ambassador to NATO, former Deputy Commandant of Forces in Divided Berlin. He's had an amazing career, and he's bringing a wealth of information and knowledge to us this hour. Also with us, Tom Nuttall, Charlemagne columnist for The Economist, joining us from Brussels. Let's hear a little bit from Donald Trump, who was at a rally on Saturday in Florida, talking about Sweden and refugees that confused pretty much everybody. Here's what the president said.
You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
President Trump talking about Sweden taking in large numbers of refugees. After those comments, Sweden's former Prime Minister Carl Bildt tweeted, "Sweden? Terror attack? What has he been smoking?" Trump later tweeted that he got his information from Tucker Carlson's show on Fox Friday. Tom Nuttall, I want to just start with you on this before we've got a bunch of callers who want to get on this conversation. But again, when you hear comments like that in Europe, give us a sense of how Europeans responded to that.
Well, I mean, I think by this point, it's probably rather similar to how a lot of people react in the United States. I mean, we are now several weeks into this presidency, and we know that this president has a habit of standing up at press conferences or during interviews or at campaign-style rallies like the one in Florida that you just ran an excerpt from, and saying things that are patently untrue. So I think this is sort of baked in now. I think the question that Europeans are starting to ask themselves, though, is to what extent can we listen to things that the president says and try and infer what policy is going to be from that? And I think what some people are starting to realize is that not very much. So we had indications from the president before he was elected that the America's security guarantee under Article 5 of the NATO treaty might be made conditional on America's allies spending more. Now, I think that's probably not where we are, and that's not what some of the members of his cabinet were saying on their trip here to Europe recently. So I think now we're in a position where we expect this stuff. We sort of bake it in to our understanding of this president, and we start to look at the policy that his government actually executes rather than whatever it is he says on Twitter or during an interview or at a rambling press conference.
Right. Let's take a call. Jeff is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Jeff, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Anthony, Mr. Nuttall, Mr. Kornblum. So there seems to be a repeated narrative now since the inauguration where, as Mr. Nuttall just explicated, the president seems to toss a rhetorical firebomb either verbally or via Twitter, and then the more experienced and more professional of his spokespeople then go out and clean up after that to the extent that they're able. And the implication or the assumption being that, we've got an inexperienced, somewhat ill-informed president. He's getting his feet wet, but don't worry. We're here to smooth things over. Let's assume for a minute that that's not the case and that these apparent mixed messages are strategic.
A sort of strategic good cop, bad cop thing, you mean, Jeff?
Exactly, precisely. And assuming for the minute that this is strategic, with, say, a Steve Bannon in the background perhaps calling some of these shots, what would the possible objective be? What would be the purpose of such a policy triangulation?
Boy, that's a big question, Jeff, but let me put it to Ambassador Kornblum to tackle in any way he wants. Mr. Ambassador, what do you think of Jeff's suggestion that if the sort of good cop, bad cop messages coming from the president and his surrogates are part of some sort of strategic plan, what would that be?
Well, I think it's a very good question, and I think he's probably right, actually. I think President Trump has sort of told us this. He believes in disruption. He believes, he uses terms like draining the swamp. He believes that the system, whatever it is, has become so stratified and so frozen in time that this is a time when we need to disrupt what's going on and we need to sort of blow it apart. Now, the interesting fact is that one of the reasons he's elected is because there's even more major disruption going on through globalization, digitalization, robots, and everything which is changing the way we live. So we seem to be coming into a phase of sort of maximum disruption. Is that good or bad? People will debate it, but I think we have to get ready for this phase.
Really, really interesting point. Let's take another call. James, thank you. So let's go to James, who's calling from Mobile, Alabama. James, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here. My observation is it seems to be a popular theory that Russia controls Trump or Trump is in league with Russia. If that were true, why would they ever allow him to push energy independence, keeping terrorists out, and stronger economy? And, of course, why would they ever allow him to push for the policy of building up the U.S. military?
Again, let me go to Ambassador Kornblum on that. What do you think of James's question, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, one could have a lot of answers to it. First, we don't know if anybody's controlled by anything. What we do know, however, I'll get back to my last word, that Vladimir Putin seems to have been almost the inventor of the policy of disruption. He's trying to disrupt everything he can. And so by pushing the United States and by pushing the American president, and remember, an American president who says he believes that he can go out and negotiate a deal with anybody, including Vladimir Putin, by pushing on President Trump the way he is, that makes him, in fact, more amenable, shall we say, to negotiations and to a deal. This is, as you pointed out and when you introduced me, I spent many years in the center of Europe dealing with Russians in the Cold War. And the approach that they always took was to push you as far as they could. If you didn't push back, they'd push a little bit more. And if you pushed back, then they would probably stop. And so I think that's probably what Putin is. I mean, he's certainly doing in Europe. And I think all of the rumors about whether he actually was in our election campaign or not may or may not even be true, but I'm sure he's actually quite happy about them because they made America feel insecure about Russia, what Russia could do to them.
Really fascinating. Ambassador Kornblum, I want to ask you about this, and this came up earlier in the hour when we didn't have you, but in a profound way, the U.S. and Europe find themselves sort of in the same boat. America's president, inward-looking populist, he raises questions about global institutions. Europe, too, is dealing with this kind of tectonic shift. Tom Nuttall made this case from Brexit to populist leaders gaining stature and power across the continent. So my question is, in this climate, how important is this kind of transatlantic cooperation, or does it need to really be reimagined in some way?
Well, both points are right. It's very important, but it also needs to be reimagined. It is, after all, as Secretary Armitage said, 70 years we've been on the current system. The United States and Europe, you can use whatever analogy you want, are joined at the hips. They have the same DNA. We live together. We are part of the same world. The famous columnist Walter Lippmann once said, the Atlantic Ocean is not an ocean dividing us. It's an inland lake. And we see this every single day, how close America and Europe are. But at the same time, we're a country of people who left Europe. All four of my grandparents left Europe because they didn't want to live in Europe. So there's a difference in perspective, a difference in psychology, and part of statecraft, what the American president is supposed to be good at, is to keep a very important relationship like this going. And since we are very much the senior power, that means that we end up spending more money on it than other people do, but the gain that we get from it is massive. And so I think that the point of is it worth doing is so self-understood that it's clear. But your point is that it probably needs reimagining is also clear. 70 years is, 70 years, it's a long time.
Yeah, Yeah. Where would there be, I mean, if you, if I was to ask you, you know, how should it be reimagined? In other words, where is there legitimate need for a change in this European-American relationship?
Well, I think, first off, that we do need somehow to have the Europeans understand that they have to be responsible partners in a way which they haven't yet understood, if I may say so. It's not so much a question of money. Of course, they should spend more for defense. But even if they did, we would still have debates about what the interests of the West are, which would very much focus on the fact that the Europeans don't want to be involved. I can tell you, as somebody who did this for a long time, and I know lots of other people in the same boat, you after a while get frustrated with the Europeans, not because they don't spend enough money, but because when you try to say, here is a problem, the Middle East is a very good example. The United States has been carrying Middle East strategy for the past 50 years. Some Europeans would say, well, that's because you didn't want us Europeans to be involved. But I can tell you that's not the case. We really wanted them to be involved, and they just didn't want to be involved. So I think we're coming to a point now where there has to be a new narrative of what Europe and America are about. And this narrative has to be very much more one of a common approach to common issues rather than the Americans always leading and telling the Europeans what to do.
Hmm. Interesting. Tom Nuttall, what do you hear in that in terms of where the legitimate need is in developing this relationship for the future?
Yeah, I agree with the points that were just made. One of the problems, though, is that Europe, partly for the reasons that I was giving a little bit earlier, is the European Union, is it really in a defensive crouch right now? In the 2000s, this was a much more confident place. We'd seen the end of the Cold War. The European Union had expanded to take in the countries of the former Warsaw Pact to the east. And there was a self-confidence of the place. There was a feeling that we could export values, that we had soft power that could extend beyond the boundaries of the European Union to encompass neighbors to the east and to the south. That mood has almost entirely evaporated now. It's all about, can we just keep this club together, because there's a real danger that it's going to fall apart. So when it comes to things like the Arab Spring, European Union, this is on the European Union's doorstep, entirely absent there. You look at the refugee crisis. That was in part the consequence of the Europeans' inability to understand that conflagrations on their doorstep could have a direct impact on them, and they weren't able to react to that until it was far too late. So while there may be a lot of American frustration with Europeans' inability to see that there should be a shared responsibility for some of these issues, that may well be justified, I think we're not in a position right. Europeans are not in a position right now to start carrying that burden along with their American allies when it comes to problems outside their own region.
Let's try to get a couple more calls in before we run out of time at the end of this hour. Daniel is calling from Colchester, Vermont. Daniel, good of you to call. What's on your mind?
Hey, Anthony. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
So, you know, I'm a Jewish American. I'm a second-generation American. But my grandparents left Europe to escape the Holocaust, kind of the worst potential consequence of nationalism. You know, NATO was created as a result of World War II. And I'm very concerned about the loss of NATO potentially. And I'm even more concerned about the sort of rise or condoning or cultivation of nationalism. And I'm curious to know what your guests have to say about that around the world, in America and in Europe.
I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Daniel, thank you for that call. Ambassador Kornblum, respond to Daniel's concern about that.
Well, Daniel's very right. And I think, again, that America has to understand, if it starts using nationalistic slogans, others are going to start the same thing. And if we just go back for one second to 1945, the reason that the great American leaders of that time decided for the first time in our history, violating George Washington's argument against alliances, to enter a European alliance was we had just had two world wars behind us and a depression. And we felt that, very rightfully in my view, that it's better to be there on the ground and make sure things are working rather than waiting for the next war to start and have to go back again, because we would go back. So this is really our insurance policy by being involved in Europe. And it's also our insurance policy not to stimulate nationalist tendencies in Europe.
I want to, our time is running short, but I have at least one more question that I want to ask you both. And Ambassador Kornblum, I'll put it to you first. The fact that we're having this conversation on this day about this decades-old transatlantic alliance, is that evidence that Europe and the U.S. are drifting apart, or perhaps further evidence that they're drifting apart? Ambassador Kornblum, to you first.
No, I don't think so. First place, again, one of the advantages of having done things a long time, I've had this same conversation again and again and again, probably for 40 years. It is part of the U.S.-European relationship that we debate with each other, which is the best representative of the Western way of life. So we're not actually drifting apart. We're actually coming closer. Globalization is bringing us closer. What we do need, what you said before, we need to rethink of the whole operation.
Right. And final thought from you, Tom Nuttall, on that same question.
I hope that Ambassador Kornblum is right. What I will say is that there are plenty of people in Europe who do believe that that this is a serious drift and possibly a permanent one, or at least a permanent one while Donald Trump is in office. And there's some evidence of this already. I'm thinking particularly of the sort of hedging strategy that the European Union is starting to put in place when it comes to trade. So before Donald Trump came to office, there was a trade deal in the works between the United States and the European Union. It was already in big trouble. But they were continuing the negotiations. Now, although Donald Trump has said nothing about this particular deal, the assumption here is that it's dead, and so they're starting to pursue deals with Japan, with Mexico, and other places. So that's where they're headed.
All right. Well, Tom Nuttall is Charlemagne columnist for The Economist. He joined us from Brussels. Tom, thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
My pleasure.
And Ambassador John Kornblum, senior counsel to the international law firm Knorr LLP and a former top diplomat to Europe and NATO, he joined us from Berlin. Ambassador Kornblum, thank you for joining us as well. It was a great pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, the conversation continues on onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.